Now, last time we made our way through some, if not all, the moves that are presented in the observation of nature. And one thing that wasn't that perhaps dwelled upon sufficiently was why we keep on encountering this striving to come up with lawful understandings of what confronts consciousness. I mean, remember that the move to reason involved consciousness, in a sense, confronting as what is something that, in a sense, represents unity of self-consciousness and its object. This is identified, you know, as reason, as what rationality really revolves around. And of course, it's also spoken of in terms of, in a way, the intrinsic conceptualizability of the given. That is identification with self-consciousness, where self-consciousness is really going to be communing with itself and communing with what is distinct from itself, is tantamount to finding the conceptual determinacy of what it confronts. And the nature of self-consciousness is identified with, in a sense you could say, conceptuality or conceptual determination in general. You know, we had it initially presented as the outcome of understanding in terms of this internal, imminent, differentiated unity, which is at one with itself, in a sense, repelling itself from itself in such a way that this differentiation is really only an internal differentiation, and thereby does not really involve confronting something really alien to itself. And this was spoken of as not only being, in some respect, the infinite, also being the process of life, but also being the process of concept, of conceptual determination, that which is conceptually determinate. And there's all sorts of talk, accordingly, of life involving, in some respect, a realization of the kind of unity the concept genuinely involves. And self-consciousness involving something that relates to itself as that kind of conceptual determination. So I think, you know, from the outset, you know, we're dealing with observation, we're dealing not just with consciousness of either, you know, objects or self-consciousness, but more specifically with a theorizing consciousness, a conceptualizing consciousness. But a conceptualizing consciousness that is engaged in observation, which means it's conceptualizing what it finds, given. Or it's finding conceptual determinacy in what it confronts, in what it finds above itself. And, you know, I think it's worth asking, why would it be that we continually find the conceptualization in question taking the form of the uncovering of laws? We had immediately the attempt to find lawful relations between all the various facets in the found givenness of what is inorganic, what is organic, and now finally when we turn to self-consciousness of various aspects of the self, both in its own interiority, in its relationship to the world it finds itself, in his own actualization, etc. Right? There's always a way of dealing with this in terms of lawfulness. And by the same token, there's always appeal to talk of this instinctive reason. And the question is, why would it be that law will figure so prominently in this? As in some respect, the surrogate for what it means to uncover conceptual determinacy, or what it means to find, in some respect, the character of self-consciousness manifest to itself in what it finds opposing it. Why would law be this form? What is the reason for this? Yeah.
So the lawful order of thinking reflected.
What's that?
In the lawful order of thinking reflected in the natural world that we're seeking.
But what I'm getting is why should, in a sense, law being that by means of which you could say self-consciousness finds itself reflected, or the concept finds itself reflected in what it confronts, what it observes. Just remember, observation. And you have to keep this in mind because you may just forget it. You know, observation is this attitude that is confronting the given. It's finding what it observes. Now, admittedly, it's going out and doing things, including such things as experimenting, as Hegel pointed out earlier. But it's experimenting upon what it finds given.
Yeah. Maybe laws are there because the observing tries to generalize the necessity from the individual things it observes. And so it sort of forms these laws by generalizing from what it observes.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, I think that, you know, there are two things you mentioned here which are significant. I think it's important to try to think of in what respect these represent specific ways in which conceptualization occurs. One is finding laws or treating conceptualization as if it were a matter of uncovering law or subjecting things to lawful determination. The other is generalization and what generalization represents. Obviously, the whole discussion of observation began with the most rudimentary generalization. That is, we just found what repeated itself, noted what repeated itself. And those repetitions, in a sense, are equivalent to a kind of generalization one could find. First of all, what is distinctive about generalization as a form of conceptualization?
Universality.
Well, look, I mean, all of these things involve universality, but they involve distinctive forms of universality. And I think it's important not to presume, as many would, that generalization is exhaustive of what universality signifies. Or by the same token, uncovering the lawfulness of phenomena is equivalent to exhausting universality, or the possible universality that could be objected. And remember, of course, we're speaking about a universalization that is objective here. Now again, I mean, if you take generalization, right, keep in mind it involves starting from the given that is particular, and to the extent that it has particulars that are going to be particulars of a universal, they of course have to be equally individual. Right? I mean, if you think about them, it's one basic thing to keep in mind, which again is, you know, often neglected by most thinkers who don't properly distinguish between particular and individual. You know, you can speak about that which is generalized about as involving a plurality of factors that each exhibit what is common to them, what one can abstract from them or extract from their givenness and find something that is generalizable or extractable or common one finds common to them. Each are particular to the extent that they are, let's say, instantiations of what they have in common. But as particular, as instantiations, as exhibiting that which binds them together, they're not distinguishable from one another. Right? To be particular refers to their relation to the universal, but in no way differentiates them from one another. And yet, to be particulars, they have to be the possibility of plurality, which requires that they be differentiated, they be individuals, not just particulars. Now, the thing with generalization is you start with individuals that are given. And the generalization picks up something that can be extracted from them. But precisely because it's that which is common to them, it in no way differentiates what individuates them. Right? That is inherently external to them, external to what binds them together. I mean, here we're speaking about a kind of generalization, a kind of thinking or universalizing that is of such a character that it is conditioned by individuals relative to them and incapable of accounting for what distinguishes them from one another, which is another way of saying that it's kind of heteronomous in its determination and really isn't fully independent. The same thing applies to law, though we saw this becoming something quite explicit in the discussion of understanding. It's what was true about law with respect to the appearances that are governed by law.
They're constant?
What?
They're constant and necessary?
Well, they might have necessity and, in a sense, constancy imputed to them. And in that regard, they were sort of the invariable in all the variations of appearances. But with regard to the same issue that I was drawing upon with regard to generalization, what is true about the law with regard to that which is governed by it?
It can't account for the particular differences between the things that fall under the law.
Yeah, I mean, everything.
It ends up being just a description of itself.
Yeah, I mean, everything that falls under the jurisdiction of the law is equal. That's why Aristotle can speak of justice as being both the lawful and the equal. Right? It doesn't distinguish what falls under it. It's indifferent to what distinguishes it. And in that respect, it doesn't in and of itself account for their the being on which the very reality of law depends. So again, there's this kind of extraneous element. So there is this kind of extraneous element, which was a problem, which had what ramifications for a so-called appearance, which ultimately was supposed to just be the manifestation of the underlying law, the supersensible. Well, it couldn't just be appearance, because it had all of this content that the law in no way determined, in no way accounted for. Now here we have reason that is going at, or let's say it's consciousness, which is going at what it finds given under the presumption what it finds given is conceptualizable, is universally determinable. It employs generalization or lawful determination over and over and over again, moving from one kind of content to another. And to some degree, it's always finding its effort to, So in a sense, verify the rationality of the given, or maybe to validate the rationality of the given as never quite being successful. And to some degree, it has to do with both what it's making use of, as well as how the given is itself characterized. Because the given is presumed to simply have this identity between self-consciousness and what opposes self-consciousness, or this identity between determinacy and what is fits the form of universality, as a given, as something that is simply present, in a, shall we say, motionless form, as if it could adequately be simply in that form. And after all, that is what it's going to be found in, the given, or as Hegel will say later, when he's characterizing observation as a whole, it's this attempt of consciousness as reason to, well, you know, to find reason in being, in the form of being. That's something that's good. So on the one hand, that which is confronting it, be it under the general heading of a nature, or those objects that are not themselves self-consciousness, are here at one with reason, or at one with universality, but immediately, independent of any process or development or anything of that sort. By the same token, the way observation goes about, let's say, discovering the truth residing in what it confronts, is by relying upon the kind of universality that has a kind of condition, one could say a conditioned character to it, and a kind of formal character to it, as exhibited in the kind of universal that results from generalization, or that which involves law. But to some degree, you might say there's no option, because after all, reason is confronting the given as simply being, having a conformability with conceptualization. Well, it has its form of being, it has its individuality. And the individuality is not something that the work of observing consciousness is going to generate. It is there already. So it's going to involve the theorizing about something whose individuality is not constituted or generated by the theorizing activity or by the activity of consciousness. It's simply there. So what consciousness does is, in a sense, going to be finding the conceptual or the theoretical truth by, in a sense, employing a kind of theorizing or conceptualizing that presupposes the individual content it's addressing, and thereby is going to, in a sense, involve the kind of formal knowing that imposes a form of universality upon a subject matter whose content is already at hand. It is not itself going to be generated through the activity of theorizing. Or at least will not entirely be generated through the activity of theorizing. Now, one thing that we didn't really discuss, and I think the text itself doesn't give us much help directly in doing this, is how the discussion at the end of the chapter of the observation of nature brings us to the observation of self-consciousness. Now, admittedly, there are a lot of parallels between what happened at the end of consciousness that led to self-consciousness. Because at the end of consciousness, what was consciousness addressing as a subject matter? Well, in a sense, it turned out to be itself as an object, but before it recognized itself as an object, it can't characterize its object.
Kingdom of laws?
Well, it went beyond that.
Another consciousness.
Well, even before it went to another consciousness. I'm speaking about section on consciousness itself at the end.
Just an unconditional universal? Are you talking at the end of forced understanding?
Yeah, that's what I mean. That is the you know, the final section of those sections that are called consciousness. But remember, life came into play. There was discussion about the infant, but there was a discussion of life, and there was also a brief discussion of genus as well. And then it sort of flipped and led us to somehow have this consideration of life, and also involving the genus, the again, moves, were very compact and not, by no means very clear, involved somehow consciousness confronting itself and moving us over to self-consciousness. Now, something similar is happening here, right? I mean, it's once again, consciousness, I'm sorry, life figures, right, as a subject matter that is being observed. It's being observed in all sorts of various ways where life as given in the form of being, in its being-like character in various respects, is somehow going to exhibit what is conceptually determinate about itself and thereby what it is in truth. And towards the end, we come to a discussion after all these attempts to get at the inner and outer of the living thing and deal with the way in which, right, the living thing in its observable phenomenality, you know, presents us with aspects of shape and the like that can't quite in their sheer givenness give us the process in which life resides, because that process is one that is continually overcoming its given shape and involving alterations of a certain kind. But, you know, that discussion then ends with talk about the genus in a very, maybe mysterious way. You know, reason with regard to the genus is trying to think about perhaps what can be said about the genus in relation to species and the like, and the speciation of the genus, and maybe the individuation of the species. And, you know, Hegel points out that, what obstacle does one find when one tries to say something theoretical about the determinations of the genus in respect to the species and individual living things that fall under it.
Yeah,
I mean, they're exceptions, and we're dealing with something that has an inherent contingency to it, which is opaque to the kind of systematization that a thoroughgoing conceptual specification would involve. But we nevertheless, we do have the genus. We do have the genus, which in a sense gives this universal determination of life process, but in a way that is, you know, in certain respects indifferent to the individualization of what that genus is pervading. Or another way of putting it, the genus pervades, you know, life forms in a way where there's a lot of overdetermination, you could say. A lot of contingency. Now, out of this situation, Hegel has us confront a consciousness that is confronting, as the object it observes, self-consciousness, but self-consciousness of a very specific sort. Because what is the character of the self-consciousness it's going to be observing to begin with? When you come to, you know, to the... I mean, remember that this whole new section where we have observation turning to self-consciousness. To some degree, it's divided in two parts, as the title indicates. It's an observation of self-consciousness in its purity and in its relation to external actuality, which is to say we have both logical and psychological laws being pursued. Well, as you know, we're first going to be looking at observation addressing self-consciousness as something in its purity, that is, in its, exhibiting a conceptual determination. But a conceptual determination within itself, right, that is distinct both from the living actuality of self-consciousness and the world that it confronts. Even if the thought that is going to be observed, which is in a way, in a sense, right, thinking of self-consciousness is going to be what is observed. Is regarded to be rational, that is, it has some purchase on objectivity. It's nevertheless being regarded as something. It is still only pertains, that is, here what is being theorized about are the laws of the thinking in its own right, as distinct from the world that those laws might relate to. Now, do any of you see any possible connection between this starting point and the, well, what appeared to be the final stages of the observation of nature, which came to an end by addressing the process of the genus and trying to think in a lawful way about it, and a thinking that was unable to find determinate laws that could apply to the genus character of life. Any clues, any way which one can see? I mean, in both cases, there's a kind of right, there's a kind of universality going on that is being distinguished from the individual realities that it itself refers to. Well, let me just, what I suggest might perhaps shed some light on this, maybe. In any event, it's a place where Hegel does say something about it, which I think you don't find him saying much at all explicitly at the end of the prior chapter on the observation of nature, is in paragraph 341. And I think, you know, as you know, Hegel, at the end of the discussion of phonology, engages in a fairly lengthy overview of what has happened in the entire development of observation. In the beginning of paragraph 341, extending to 342, through 343, and then into 344, which you will be mulling over. But if you look on at paragraph 341, you know, Hegel here sort of goes back and gives a very brief summation of generally what has happened and how things are divided up in terms of the different shapes and how they're distinguished from one another. He points out that to begin with, in the first mode of observation, right, we had an observation of the relationships obtaining an inorganic nature, and you know, their sensuous being had, in the eyes of observing consciousness, already vanished. It vanished in the sense that the relations of, you know, of inorganic nature were being regarded as being in truth what was generalizable, right? What was lawfully at hand, namely these pure abstractions, these simple concepts, which are supposed to be firmly tied to the existence of things. But this tended to break down. And in a sense, what we're left with was a pure movement and a universal, a pure movement in which, right, the sensuous given for being overturned, a movement which could be identified with the organic being this process in which, you know, the sensuous is subject to a continuous process and change, alterations, which this unity is continually reaffirms itself. So this moved on to an observation of life, and this is where I want us to see what he has to say here that might shed some light on the transition. And it goes on to say that, well, here, what was, in a sense, confronting observation, confronting the theorizing of observing consciousness, was something he describes as something self-related, negative essence. It's freestanding on its own, right? It differentiates itself. In that regard, it could be said to be a negative, negating itself, altering itself, yet remaining in one, not depending upon other things for this. But nevertheless, the concept remained something that was only the inner inorganic nature. It couldn't find its true expression in organic existence. That's what was found to be given. And then he goes on to say, the organic process is merely free in itself, but not for itself. It is in the purpose that the being for self of its freedom emerges, and it exists as another essence, as a wisdom aware of itself, which is external to the process. Observing reason thus addresses itself to this wisdom, to the concept existing as universality, that is, to purpose existing as purpose, and henceforth its own essence is the object. Now that's about all he gives us, really, to try to point to the transition. I mean, but it's a point that he's given at various junctures about the organic process and distinguishing it from self-consciousness. You know, it has this freedom, this self-differentiating, self-determining character. It does have that character in itself, but it is not relating to itself in that way. It doesn't relate to itself as being self-differentiating, self-determining. And that if there is any kind of self-relatedness, it exists apart from it somewhere else. Something external to the process. Is this, think about the genus in this regard, because Hegel will often speak in these terms, so he'll speak about the genus as being something that in a way gives the life process a articulated universal realization. Because the genus, after all, pervades the individual living things. And is that which is, in a sense, is their universality. Because after all, they all belong to the genus. But they're not universal for themselves. They have to give themselves up to allow the genus to persist, namely they're mortal, they die, etc. Where they reproduce, and they have to go beyond themselves to generate the universal. In that respect, their universal character is not something that they are, that they relate themselves to. Their universal character is to be found in something else. Or another way of putting it, their universal determination, in a way, lies outside of the actual individual life form. It's something that is being determined by, it's there in the genus, and their relation to the genus is not really something for them other than in reproduction. But, you know, they go beyond themselves through reproduction to form the genus. Not really relating to genus, to themselves as universal. But theorizing observation is doing that. Now, note how he characterizes the way in which observation turns to mind here. In paragraph 342, he speaks here of observing reason that first addresses itself to its purity. And he says, since observing reason apprehends the object which moves itself in its differences as an existence, the laws of thought become for it relations between something abiding and something else abiding. But since the content of these laws are merely moments, these laws blend together into the one of self-consciousness. And then this new object, likewise taken as existence, is individual contingent self-consciousness. What is he talking about here? If you think back on how this development is discussed, what particular move is he referring to? What divisions of the discussion is he summarizing?
It sounds like self-consciousness.
Well, what parts? Because in a way, here, okay, paragraph 342 is giving a kind of overview of the first two parts of the observation. Self-consciousness. If you think about it as having, in a certain respect, three major sections, although they're extremely unequal in length. You know, the first section is extremely compressed, and we'll look at it in a moment, which is dealing with what could be considered, well, an observation of logic, of thinking, as it's given, and of uncovering the laws of thinking as it is given, you know, descriptive logic. But then that leads, as you know, into a discussion of the actual individual self-consciousness, which as an individual is in the world and is relating to the world, and to just look at what kind of lawful relationships can be found. And Hegel describes this in what terms, how does he characterize this kind of theorizing?
Physiology.
What?
Physiology.
Well, I think, he says psychology, actually.
Oh,
psychology here. Because it's more about in what way there's any kind of lawful determining going on between the individual self-consciousness and the world it is located within. And then you have, as in a sense, the third broad heading of what is under discussion, an attempt to look at self-consciousness in its own individual actuality, namely in his own embodiment, and to see what can be said in a lawful way about that, about self-consciousness in relationship to its own living embodiment and the different aspects of its living embodiment. So those are the basic stages along the way. And the first is, as we see adumbrated here in a very abstract way, is we simply have self-consciousness as doing nothing but thinking. And whereas thinking is being considered independently of its relation to other things, independently of relation to its own embodiment. That is, it's being regarded simply in a logical way, but an empirically logical way or a descriptively logical way. We're observing what can be found to be lawful in thinking. And it's extraction from thinking from what is universal in mind. You know, may bear some resemblance to what the observation of life confronts at the very end when it's confronting the genus in connection to the rest of organic reality. And finding no determinate lawfulness to be uncovered. And thereby finding that kind of universality in its own right detached from the rest. Yeah, Dylan, did you have something?
No.
What I suggest, let's leave in abeyance this transition, see if we can come up with any. I invite you to see if you can come up with more that would help us in seeing. I mean, but I would just suggest Hegel points to this, to the genus in relationship to the rest of organic life as being the final topic. And the attempt to uncover any kind of lawful relationships is unsuccessful. And through this failure, consciousness ends up confronting itself as the object of rational observation, but itself in the specific manner of being a mind that is just thinking in itself without any determining of the environment or its own given actuality being at stake. And that's what we have here in the observation of the laws of thought. Now, I'd like us, before we break, is to at least look at the few paragraphs that really deal with this. And really, you know, only only two. Did you?
Oh, no, sorry.
No. If you look at paragraph 299, this is where, you know, Hegel, in 298, just speaks of what he mentioned previously, observation of nature, found the concept realized in inorganic nature's laws, whose moments as things would become abstractions, but the concept did not have simplicity reflected into itself, that is, its unity was not reflected into itself, and all the multiplicity of what was thought of or theorized about in terms of these abstractions. Life had the simplicity reflected into itself, but here the essence of life was not itself the genus. It was the genus, even though it gave, in a sense, the universal determination of life, it wasn't able in doing that to really lay hold of what distinguishes the species and the individuals of the species. So observation finds this free concept. Note how he puts it. Observation finds this free concept as universality, as that developed individuality equally absolutely within itself. Is found by observation only in the concept existing as a concept itself, that is, in self-consciousness. But it couldn't find the universality giving itself its determinacy in life itself, even though the genus presented something universal, but that universality did not reach down and penetrate the contingent realization of the genus and species and individuals. But that nevertheless was what was regarded to be essential. Now we're confronting something of that sort in its own right, which is that of self-consciousness here as this process of universal determination. And what is that process of the universal determining itself? As an objective reality. You know, it's a reality of the self-thinking. Engaged in thinking. And we're going to observe that. So when observation, as he says in paragraph 299, now turns back into itself and directs itself to the actual concept as the free concept, concept, the process of the, you know, intrinsically determining concept as something actual. We're dealing with thinking as an actual reality. Well, thinking as an actual reality is the thinking of self-consciousness as something to be observed. And since it's going to be observed as something given to observation, it's going to be, its true character is going to be observed by uncovering its laws. But this then automatically is going to involve certain consequences that are going to turn out to be problematic. And Hegel lays these out very briefly in these two sections. Now he points out, first of all, we're dealing with the thinking. It's being considered in its own right. So the thoughts are not being considered in the relationship to anything else. So this means, although they're being considered apart from what they might be thoughts about, that doesn't mean that they themselves are without truth, as he points out, but it just means that they're being considered in a formal way, with regard to what kind of formal truth they might have. Now remember the thoughts which are here being examined are also the thoughts of the self-consciousness that is doing the observing. And the thoughts of the self-consciousness that are doing the observing are presumed to be objective, that is, to lay hold of reality. Now the question is, can the thinking of thinking that is here being performed indeed lay hold of the reality it confronts? Can, you might say, the thinking of the observation of thought be something that is going to be able to adequately lay hold of thought as it finds it? And paragraph 300, Hegel characterizes, how thought appears as something given for observation. Has a found given only existing context. And as a found given context, there are two features that he points to that are bound up with its being simply given and found. Right? He says we have a motionless being of relations, and an aggregate of separated necessities, which is supposed to have truth as a rigid content and infer themselves in their determinacy. And this, in a sense, is exhibited in the fact that what do we uncover? We uncover a plurality of different laws of thought. The laws lay hold of the motionless givenness of thinking, and they present us with, in a sense, aggregates of separated necessities. Each law is a kind of separated necessity. Now, why are they, in what sense do they have a kind of motionless, rigid character, a fixed character? In what sense do they have a kind of separated character? And why are these features a problem for observation to be, in a sense, validate its attempt to uncover the logic of self-consciousness?
Static, which
turns the content or the form of self-consciousness into something static, which it isn't. He says that it just kind of imports our conception of being into
thought. Well, it says, and you know, that's what we're doing if we confront thinking as something given, as a given phenomenon in the world that we're attempting to theorize about or capture. It has a given content of its own. It has its own individual reality in the form of being, something confronting us. So it's there. And it presents a multiplicity of determinations. Otherwise it couldn't be determinate. And they're just there, side by side. And they present, right, different, universal relationships. Different kind of lawful connections. Each of which is simply given, beside one another. Because after all, they're given. They have a kind of immediate being. And we are here observing sort of the givenness of thought. And so there's not much we can do except to try to lay out the laws that capture this. Now, why is there a problem with there being this plurality of determinations that are lawful and fixed and separate from one another?
They're supposed to be formal, devoid of any individuating content. So, but they'd have to have some kind of individuating content to be kept separate. So they can't remain formal.
Well, in what sense are they formal? I mean, why would we be thinking that what we're doing is formal if you think about the general approach of observation? You know, we'll be looking for the patterns in thought. So in other words, patterns that would apply to any thinking, right? Thinking of anything. So the general rules that apply to thought, which is fine as given. And they're laid out as these fixed commonalities. And a plurality of them. Insofar as we're dealing with some, you know, determinate being of thinking. But what then becomes the problem? Why is this problematic about this being the truth?
Yeah. Is it problematic that there's no unity of self-consciousness, that there's no unity of the thought, we have this plurality?
Well, why is there a need for unity here? I mean, there is this plurality. We find all sorts of determinations are given in thought. We're looking for what is universal in them. We find a plurality of laws that can be applied to this multifarious given content of thinking. And as given, we find different determinations. They're there. Well, remember, as there and different, there's nothing about them that. I mean, you could say that in terms of their rigidity, their givenness, they sort of abide by the principle of non-contradiction. They are what they are. They are not what they are not. And insofar as they're not what they're not, they don't themselves transform themselves into anything else. They don't relate themselves to what they're not. They just are. That's this manifold of thinking. Which means the unity of them is to be found outside them. Right? So either that unity is a subjective unity that we're imposing upon them, or there's no intrinsic unity, no way of establishing their exhaustive character or the like. But by the same token, any necessity to what is there. You just sort of find, right, thought determinations. And the same problems apply to the finding of thought determinations as the finding of any kind of regularities in inorganic nature, for that matter. And to guarantee that these have any genuine universality, right, the same kind of problems can arise. You know, you can think about the dilemmas, trying to ensure that the discovered rules are really rules that won't have exceptions in the life, and that are exhaustive, that there aren't others that haven't been uncovered and the like. Yes.
How do we even have determinations? I mean, where's this determinacy going to come from if they're supposed to be universal, that generalizability of thought, or the what is generalizable about thought, if they're supposed to be the laws of thought, then why not just the principle of non-contradiction? How do we get a multiplicity? Unless they have some content. But it seems like they couldn't have any content.
Well, they have a content that we find. It's there. You might ask, well, where is it? Well, you could say it's there by introspection. It's there in the utterances of others. It's there in books. It's there in many different places where one can encounter it. And one can generalize about it, reflect on it, and so forth. Now, Hegel makes the following point on page 265. He says, you know, they're not the truth of thought because they're supposed to be merely formal and have no content, but rather for the opposite reason. Because as a content from which form has been taken, they're supposed to count as something absolute. In their truth, as vanishing moments in the unity of thought, they would have to be taken to be knowledge, but not to be the laws of knowledge. So what is he getting at here? In what respect are they content from which form has been taken? And for those of you who have read either the Introduction to the Science of Logic or Parts of the Science of Logic, that I think give you some sense of what he's getting at. But what would it mean for a content from which form has not been taken? What would that say about the content in question? Well, it would be a content that forms itself, or a content that orders itself. But here we have a content that does not order itself. In what respect does the content of thought understood as being specified in a plurality of laws, a content that does not order itself or form itself? Well, first of all, it doesn't determine itself, right? It's determined by the thinking that observes and finds and uncovers these patterns, regularities, and so forth, and then specifies them. But also, there's nothing about the individual laws that gives them an ordering. They're external to one another. They don't connect themselves to one another. They in no way order themselves.
Do they do?
They're simply givens.
Do they do anything? Can we talk about them as thought or thinking anymore?
I mean, in a sense, they manipulate contents about which they're thinking. But they're not manipulating themselves or relating themselves to other thought determinations. They're just are what they are. Whereas by contrast, in their truth, as vanishing moments in unity of thought, they would be taken to be knowledge. Now you might ask yourself, what would it mean for them to be vanishing moments in unity of thought? And why would they then not be laws of thought? If they would be vanishing moments, that means somehow they, in virtue of what they are, would, in a sense, generate something other than themselves, and thereby vanish. Just as, for example, the life process is continually having its current situation vanishing because it's moving itself in various respects, it's altering itself. Well, remember, if thinking were such that it was self-altering, it would generate different terms, right? Different relationships. But then none of its terms would themselves be laws, because laws are fixed. They don't alter. And they apply to things that are, right, distinct from themselves, that they don't exhaustively determine. So here, in a sense, look, you have thought as something given, as something to be found and described accordingly in a universal way, which means it then gets set up as a kind of formal, logical, descriptive system whose unity is contingent, whose contents are contingent. There's nothing about them that intrinsically connects them to one another or unites them in any particular way. But you know, if you wanted to say whether they are. Being united, well, I mean, they are being held together, obviously, by the observing consciousness, but they're not intrinsically held together. Now, Hegel points out that here, observation inverts its nature into the shape of being. That is, it grasps its negativity merely as laws of being. It is sufficient to have pointed out the invalidity of the so-called laws of thought on the basis of the universal nature of what is at issue. You know, we don't have to go into it in any greater detail, which is something he claims is done in speculative philosophy, which shows that thought determinations do end up vanishing, do end up transforming themselves, do end up connecting themselves to something different from themselves. Well, what is the invalidity of the so-called laws of thought on the basis of the universal nature of what is at issue? What is the universal nature of what is at issue? That makes what is found to be inadequate.
Truth in general, that the universal nature of what's at issue.
Yeah, but how is that construed here? That means that the laws of thought, that the mere fact that here we have thought being grasped as governed by laws, laws that are found, laws that have an immediate fixed being.
The laws treat thoughts as something fixed when the thoughts themselves are moving, transforming.
I mean, how is that really, this idea that you might say thinking is not going to be just fixed and have a given content. How is that built into what's at stake here? What's the underlying...
Is it simply corresponds to life? Life doesn't exhibit that character.
Well, I think even more than life. I think more of just the whole presumption of reason as a shape of consciousness. Because what's the nature of reason with regard to, you could say, thought?
It's the identity of the thinking and the object of thought. So there's the transformation back and forth from subjective to object.
And it means that thought is... Is it one with itself and something distinct from itself? The thought does differentiate itself, meaning it gives itself new determination. It doesn't just stay what it is. And by the same token, it has, well, as he goes on to say, an individuality. That is, because it has this internal difference, it is something that gives itself its content. In such a way that the content it gives itself is also one that it pervades. And it doesn't become something else. It remains at one with itself. In this respect, he claims in paragraph 301 that the observation of self-consciousness finds any sense that it can find truth in observing its thinking as a bunch of laws that are observed. That can't possibly uncover its reality. So we now have self-consciousness being observed in a different respect. Self-consciousness in its individuality. And in its actual individuality. And in particular, in its active, real individuality, not as a fixed, unmoving array of lawful determinations. So this is something that then becomes the next subject matter. So I suggest, why don't we take a break for about 7 minutes and then look at this comparatively brief discussion of what's involved observing self-consciousness as something individual and actual and related to the world in which it finds itself.